Hey everybody, welcome to another Sharing Our Pairings, Episode 7. Here to talk about wine, I'm your host, John, the Cigar Surgeon. I'm here with Tony Bellotto of La Barba Cigars. Tony, welcome to
the
show.
Hello, hello. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on short notice. We jumped on you pretty fast from the odd-timed Monday cigar chat when you started talking about wines. My ears really perked up.
Cool, man. Yeah. Yeah, I had a good time. It was a good show. I'm excited to be on this one.
So, I think you mentioned on the show, and maybe for the audience out there that don't know, you said you're a level 3 sommelier, and there's probably a lot of people out there that don't even know what a sommelier is. So, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, when I got done with college, I fell in love with wine. I always hated it when I was younger, and then as I became an adult, I really started to fall in love with it and left a real college degree to go to wine school.
Wow.
And basically what it is we would do about 2 hours in classroom, and then we would do about an hour of tasting. So that was the first level. And when I started into it, you know, I would read all these things on Wine Spectator or you know, any of the wine blogs where I'd be talking to people and they would say, oh, I get this like vanilla note or this creamy note or black currant or whatever. And I'm like, before I went to wine school, I thought those were actual things in wine.
Oh, like actual substances.
Right. So then I went up there and I was like, you know, she started spouting off about all the things she tasted. And I was like, I'm way over my head. Like, this is going to be impossible. And then eventually I just kind of fell into it. And then we would do, you know, she would, most of it's a lot of it's history. So a lot of it is regional history. A lot of it is why grapes are grown where they're grown. A lot of it is why spirits are made where they're made. And a lot of it is subsequently tasting. So those are the two big parts in it. And then as you go up the ladder, you get more kind of focused on specific regions. So the first level would be French wine. The second level would be Bordeaux wine, and then the third level would be right bank Bordeaux wine. So you're getting more and more concentrated on all those specific things. And at the end,
sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say at the end of the course, you took a test and then you did a blind taste.
And that was the test? Like you have to score high on the blind test in order to pass? Is that the idea?
Yeah, there was pass with distinction, pass with merit, and then just pass, and then fail. So that was for the written part. You get a separate thing for the written part, and you get a separate thing for the tasting part. And then those things combined had to get you a pass or above. So I think it was 80% or above was a pass. So.
Wow. So they're not fooling around then. I mean, 80% is not exactly a small mark.
No.
So not to put you on the spot or anything, but how did you do?
Well, on the first two, I passed with merit, which is a little bit better than passing. And then on the third one, I passed with distinction, which is the top 2% of anyone that's ever taken a test. So,
wow.
Not too shabby.
No, not too shabby at all. So what I'll do here, because I wanted to sort of cover probably more than what we've got time for tonight, but that's usually what I do. So I'm smoking a Carillo Short Run. I was actually last minute trying to figure out what I wanted to smoke, and I probably, as I always do, grabbed something I wasn't quite sure was going to pair, so we'll see how that turns out. But I've got a Taylor Fladgate 10-year port. And you had asked me before the show whether it was a Tawny or a, and I can't remember the other one.
Ruby.
Now, just sort of off topic for a second, what is the difference between a Tawny and a Ruby port?
The difference between a Tawny and a Ruby port is basically an extreme amount of age. So Ruby ports are still aged in cask, but Tawny ports are aged for a longer period of time. And usually with port making port, what they'll do is they'll put the port in a Solaris system. So they'll have port from, you know, 1970 all the way to 2013, and they'll pour out of the bottom barrel. So the wine will move down via gravity through the pipe or through the barrels, and you'll be drinking mixed or blended port from anywhere between 1970 and 2013. So a 10-year port basically means that the minimum age is 10 years.
Oh,
same with
the
20 or 30.
So I mean, really, that shares a ton with the Scotch and whiskey industry, then.
Right. So, and then if you look at like a vintage port, so say you have a 2007 vintage port, and I always get my friends that have kids a bottle of vintage port because it won't be ready to drink for exactly 21 years, is what they say. So it's something cool that you could drink with your son or daughter when they come of age. But that is all from a specific vintage, and it's all barrel together. So vintage ports typically tend to be a little bit more expensive than your 10, 20, or 30-year tawnies.
Interesting. Well, we can probably talk a little bit about aging because this is one of the few beverages, and I guess we'll come back to that, that aging, in fact, does occur once the beverage is bottled.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, it's a very important thing. You know, the wine is still alive when it's bottled, and you can drink, you know, certain ports and certain wines for 50, 75 years after they've been bottled. So, and it totally changes the dynamic of the beverage. So.
Well, I'll keep us on topic because we haven't even gotten to what you're drinking. So, first beverage is a Taylor Fladgate 10-year. I've got an Argento Malbec from Mendoza, I believe. I've got a Gabbriano Chianti. And for those out there who can see, there's actually mist coming from my mouth because it is, in fact, that cold today in Calgary. Welcome to summertime in Calgary. And I've got a Gewürztraminer, a white, because I'm a crazy man, from the Okanagan Valley.
Well, ironically, I have a white as well.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I have 2012 Rodney Strong Chalk Hill Chardonnay. I have a red blend from Joel Gott and Dave Finney. It's called iChart. And I have a 2008 Napa Valley Cab from Caravan. And they were all actually given to me by my good friend who is a wine rep, Matt Frampton, donated the wine for this lovely taste today.
Oh,
and he wanted me to give him a shout out, so I gave him. Well, he didn't want me to. I volunteered it. It's Zorro Jones on Instagram.
Yeah, no, I think it's only fair if somebody isn't that how it works? If somebody gives you a free bottle, that you got to give their dues.
Yeah, absolutely.
That only seems reasonable to me. So getting back to the wine bit for a second. So you're talking about part of being a sommelier was obviously, and I guess it's like any sort of education where you start out on a broad topic. And you just get further and further and further into something very, very finite and specific. So, I mean, how far down the rabbit hole do you go with wine? I mean, how specialized can that get?
I mean, it can get specialized all the way. You know, if you're sitting with a master of wine, you know, which I've talked to before, he can smell and taste a glass of wine and tell you what year it's from and what vineyard it's from. I can't get there. I can get pretty close. Like, I know this is from California, and I could tell that it's between a 2008 and a 2010. You know, I could tell those things, and I could tell, you know, I could pick out point in certain flavor profiles, and I can pick out certain things in wine by tasting it, but these guys are pretty insane, and I don't even know if there's a point where I think you just stop learning and just have to have a natural ability for it, and I'm worried that I'm going to get to that point, you know? So... where I just can't go any farther. But you know, a big thing and a big reason, you know, where the sommeliers came from was they had to taste the king's wine to make sure it wasn't poisoned. So they had to taste a very little amount of wine to tell that it was legit. And that's, I guess, where the whole thing comes from, is you have to taste a little bit of wine and be able to pull out all the flavors, be able to tell how long it's going to age, be able to tell, because obviously we're not worried about getting poisoned. Although I have a lot of mad ex-girlfriends. You know, that's essentially where it came from. So a lot of it has to do with tasting faults in wine. You know, if you smell or taste wet cardboard, you know, you have that TCA taint, or they call it corked wine.
Yeah.
You know, if it smells like vinegar, it's obviously bad. I mean, you know all the rules, but That's an important part of assessing a wine. To put in, you know, to put in a shop or to put into a customer's hands, you have to know. You can't drink a whole bottle of everything. You have to taste a little bit and then be able to explain to them what's going on with the wine. And I think that's an important part about being a sommelier.
So, I mean, obviously, there's a whole lot of, when you talk about tasting, there's a whole aspect of that in terms of the glass you use, whether the beverage is chilled or not, whether or not the beverage has been rested or not. So, you know, I've heard a lot of, and this might be a big question before we're about to take a break, but I guess more specialized to you, do you typically chill your wines before you drink them, or is it going to really depend on the type of wine?
It really depends on the type of wine. You know, I like my Chardonnays between, you know, between 40 and 50 degrees, just because that's, I think, where the maximum flavor comes out. Too cold and you're not getting enough flavor, and too warm you're getting too much of that. Like, you know, we could talk about the malolactic fermentation and barrel aging later, but, you know, depending on that type of wine, if it, you know, the Chardonnay that I'm drinking is barrel aged, because there's no way to be able to hold up to the cigar if it wasn't, and those I'll typically drink a little bit cooler because it tones down those big milky, buttery, toasty notes a little bit. And then my red wine I usually drink at cellar temperature, which is between 55 and 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
So really when somebody says, you know, because the common sort of pedestrian understanding, which is certainly me, is red wines are consumed at room temperature, and it sounds like that's, you know, not quite right, because you are talking about a beverage that is slightly chilled below what we commonly would expect, depending on who you've got for a girlfriend and how warm room temperature is.
Right. Well, I mean, as it looks where you're at, man, it looks like you could drink red wine outside all summer and be okay. So.
Yeah, well, normally it'd be a lot warmer here, so I actually did put my wines out here partially to breathe, partially because I knew they were actually going to chill. I mean, it's only, I have to convert from metric to freedom units, but I think it's about 58 or 59 right now, so it is definitely on the cool side. I mean, I can see my breath, so probably perfect temperature to be drinking a nice red wine.
It is perfect. That is a perfect temperature.
But we're about that time here. We're going to take our first break for our listeners out there for Armed Forces Radio Network. Appreciate them tuning in. Please appreciate them covering us. So we're going to take a quick break here. And we're back here with Tony Bellotto of La Barba Cigars. Tony, earlier you were mentioning maybe you want to give another shout-out to your friend who was generous enough to donate some wine.
Yeah, Matt Frampton. He's a distributor of mine. He donated all the wines I'm drinking tonight. His name is Matt Frampton. You can follow him on Instagram. Zorro Jones is his handle, because everybody thinks he looks like Zorro.
Is it a mustache thing, or does he like to wear big brimmed hats, or what's the deal?
apparently, the story goes that he was walking around in Southern Ohio, and that's where, not Southern Ohio, but south of me, so northeastern Ohio, and he was an engineer with a long ponytail, and he looks kind of Spanish, but he's not, and they used to bust his chops about looking like Zorro, and they would always call him Zorro, so then he picked the Jones as kind of like a, you know, I'm not really Zorro, I don't know, you have to ask him.
Maybe we'll have him on the show sometime.
Yeah.
So before we broke, we were talking a little bit about beverage chilling. You were mentioning that you have a wine cellar, and obviously red wine is not actually served at room temperature. It is slightly chilled, or, you know, as we like to call up in Calgary, summertime.
Yeah.
So maybe we can circle back for a second and talk a little bit about the aging of wines. Because, you know, in front of me I've got a 10-year port, which, you know, is... Ports are a totally different beast, but I've got a 2002, I've got a 2010, and I've got a 2012. So I've got a variety of different ages on these, and like we were mentioning, wine, unlike whiskey, is one of the beverages that actually ages inside the bottle. So I mean, what's the deal there?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a lot like cigars as far as, you know, you're and I'm smoking an Eastern Standard. I didn't go over that yet, but.
Called
ironically, Yeah, Caldwell Cigar Company. Ironically enough, Jeremy, the California hillbilly, is in town, and in fact, at my shop. He's sleeping on my couch and hitting the Midwest territory. So, so the cigar was donated by him and Caldwell.
So really, it's a free ride for you tonight, all around the
absolutely, map. And that's why I'm in this business.
I'm in the wrong business.
But yeah, aging wine is a lot like aging cigars in that, you know, you're not distilling the beverage, so it's not 100% grain alcohol. You still have a lot of residual sugar in wine. You still have a lot of tannin in wine, and you still have a lot of things that aren't imparted by the oak. And you even have things that are imparted by the oak. But what happens with the wine is you have a substantial amount of tannin. White wines obviously don't age as well as red wines because they don't have any tannin in them. Tannin is the stuff that makes your lips feel fuzzy when you drink black tea or drink a really dry, what they call dry red wine. So depending on the tannin structure of the wine, what happens is over time, those molecules, I'm going to get really geeky here, what happens over time is these molecules will hit and form chains within the bottle of wine, and the tannin structure will eventually fall out of the wine. So as these molecules are hitting, they'll kind of form chains. And then I don't know if you've ever drank a wine where you've poured it and there's been a lot of sediment in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's those chains that were not in the wine. And, you know, in a 2008, you might have a little bit of that, but as this wine gets older and older and older, those tannins and those things that made the wine really abrasive young will fall out and essentially mellow the wine out. And there's a tipping point where, you know, the wine goes good. You have to drink it now, and then it just falls off.
So there is obviously a lot of parallels then between that and the cigar industry, because there are certain cigars that I've certainly found you can age them to a certain point, and that's, you know, as far as they'll go, and maybe you can sort of hold the flavor profile at that level for a little while, but then you start to get a rapid decline in just how good it is.
Right.
There must be a huge aspect to the wine industry in terms of understanding how wines age and at what point, you know, you're hitting that critical fall off on the graph. And that, I mean, how many, just what, tens of thousands of different wines out there?
Yeah, and you know, actually, ironically enough, Matt, the guy I was talking about earlier, brought a bunch of California wines from the 70s. And he brought in really high-end wines. Inglenook from back then was a really high-end wine. We drank a couple first-growth Bordeaux that night, all from the 70s. And then me and him were sitting there, and we're like, there's no way these things are going to be good. There's no way. And we opened them all, and all of them were very drinkable. None of them had been, and they were all stored properly. And none of them had gone bad, even with California cabs, which is a very strange thing. Usually you're at, like, you know, 20 years at the most for California wines, 35 to 40 with French. So we were very surprised by that. So you never know. I mean, sometimes you could keep it for 10 and it'll go bad, and sometimes you could keep it for 40 and it'll be great.
But, I mean, it sounds kind of fun, especially if you have a cellar full of wine.
Yeah.
So I'll switch gears up a little bit, because we've actually got some good audience questions, and we'll take the top one from Stefan, which is sort of a general pairing question. Stefan says he's not paired a lot of cigars with wine. He's typically pairing with coffee, beer, bourbon, and he's kind of just looking for some basic advice of what's your recommendation for a guy to start pairing wine and cigars? How does a guy get started with that?
The best thing to do, in my opinion, is to go for it. I mean, you're going to make errors, and sometimes you're going to try to pair stuff, and it's going to suck, you know. And I think that's honestly the best way to start is to just pick two things that you really like and see if they go together. But it's just like pairing with whiskey or coffee or whatever. You either want to try to find something that totally compares flavors or totally contrasts flavors. So, for example, I'm smoking this Eastern Standard, which is a very mellow cigar. Dark Connecticut. It's got a lot of flavorful filler tobacco in it that's spicy, but I picked the Chardonnay because they're both very similar in flavor profile. But for a Cabernet, which is especially in California, you got the big juicy fruit and the black currants and the and all that. You probably would want to go with something a little bit spicy, because it's all those wines are almost sweet. And then on the flip side, you know, you pick a Bordeaux or something that's very earthy, or the Chianti you're going to drink. And I would say, you know, you want to smoke something sweet, maybe like a Connecticut broadleaf. So you either want to totally compare or totally contrast flavors, but you don't want to go anywhere in between that. And I think that that's maybe the most useful advice I can give.
Well, and, you know, that seems to be a common theme. We've gone through whiskey, we've gone through bourbon, beer, and now we're on wine. And that does seem to be a pretty consistent theme, that you're either contrasting or building on that profile. But one of the interesting questions I think that came up in the last show was, would you typically pair a cigar with a wine to enhance the cigar, enhance the wine, or something else completely different?
Personally, I do it to enhance my palate. You know, they say when you're tasting and evaluating wines, as a sommelier, you're not supposed to eat anything, because the food enhances the wine and the wine enhances the food. It's a handshake. And I think the same goes for cigars or bourbon or whatever, pairing anything. You know, they handshake each other and they amplify the flavors of both. So if I'm at a table with a bunch of people and, you know, someone orders fish and someone orders chicken and someone orders beef, the idea is that when they look to me to order a bottle of wine, I try to order something that'll be suitable for all those meals for everybody at the table. If everybody orders steak, I definitely know what I'm getting, but you know, you have to kind of put those all into perspective when you're doing that, and you take into consideration everything before you dive right in, I think is the best way to look at it. So I'm drinking and smoking for my palate. I'm drinking and smoking for me. If that helps you out at all.
Well, I think it does. I mean, I at the risk of just being a head nodder, I'm kind of the same way. I do like to push my palate. I found that the more I drink, the more I smoke, the more I'm actually moving away from picking one thing and doing the same thing over and over, and instead I'm picking something that I wouldn't otherwise try. Because I want to challenge myself. I want to see if I can appreciate it or understand it otherwise, I guess, build myself as a person, I guess, through booze.
And that's the fun thing about it.
So I'm kind of getting rained on here, which is an interesting experience. So I'll talk a little bit, maybe you can talk a little bit about your pairing so far. So I started out with the port. I'm probably going to have to circle back in another show and talk about it. The port pairing is actually really good. I think the sweetness of the port is not blowing out my cigar. I switched over to the Malbec about 5-10 minutes ago, and the Malbec, as I kind of expected, because it's such a huge mouthfeel, it's very thick and really washing out the cigar. I would definitely not pair a Malbec with a lighter cigar. This is something I think that needs, you know, a full-bodied cigar, something heavy.
Yeah.
Maybe one of those Neanderthals that Logan was smoking a few days ago and going on about. How's your pairing going so far?
It's good. You know, I'm gonna probably have to switch up the cigar when I go to the cab. But for the red blend, which I can't remember exactly what this blend is. I think it's Cab Merlot, Petite Syrah, and a little bit of Malbec. I will check that out in a second here, because Matt sent me the tasting sheet on it. But the Chardonnay was unbelievable with this Eastern Standard. And I think, like we were saying before, it's because of that comparing of flavors. It's a medium-bodied cigar, and it's got a lot of spice, but in retrospect, the Chardonnay is barrel-aged, so there's a lot of malolactic fermentation, and it was aged for a nice period on the lees, and I think that brings the Chardonnay up to the level of cigar smoking. You know, one of my dad's favorite things is white Burgundy with Ashton Classic, and that's like an afternoon kind of thing for him. He'll smoke that Ashton White Label Classic with a stainless steel fermented Chardonnay, and he really likes Ashton Cabinets with them.
So you're talking two things there that are very, very subtle,
right? And I think that again, that's a total comparison of flavor. You're smoking something that's very mild, but you're drinking something that's it's bright, but it's very light. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. And in my understanding, because I was reading about this in rum aging, so hopefully I'm correct here that the steel aging of the wine is not in, because most of your flavors are coming from the wood. Is that correct?
Yeah, most of the flavors in California Chardonnay come from what's called malolactic fermentation, and that's changing the malic acid, which is in apples, into lactic acid, which is in milk, and that's where you get that buttery kind of toasty flavor. And the toasty flavor comes from the fact that they age the wine on what's called lees, and that's the dead yeast. And what happens when yeast die is they emit almost like a biscuity kind of flavor, like a toasted biscuit kind of flavor, and that's very typical of California Chardonnays. On the flip side, the white Burgundies do not undergo malolactic fermentation. What happens with white Burgundies is they ferment the wine. They don't ferment it on any skins, on any stems. They just ferment it in stainless steel. It actually started in concrete before there was such a thing as stainless steel. So you're getting a lot of citrus flavors out of wines like that.
Well, we're going to take another quick pause here for another commercial. AFR and Radio, thanks for listening. Everybody out there, stay safe. Welcome back, everybody. We're here, the seventh episode of Sharing Our Pairings, talking about wine. We're here with Tony Bellotto. This segment is brought to you by the ALS Challenge. If you haven't already done so, please make a donation to the ALS Foundation. It's more entertaining if you do the bucket challenge and the donation. Logan's got a thread set up. We're all having a pretty good time. Have you done the ALS challenge yet, Tony?
Oh, not yet. I mean, I've been nominated quite a few times, and I still have yet to do it. I've been too busy, so I'm gonna try to do it tonight or tomorrow. But I already lost the 24-hour challenge, so I'm donating enough. So I'll still do it just for the fun of it, but I'm still gonna donate for sure because it's a great cause.
Yeah, it is a great cause. So getting back to the wine discussion here. So you had mentioned on Monday one of your go-tos was the purple LaBarba. Is that right? In a cab set?
Yeah. Especially the Treasure Hunter cab that I was drinking, and Hunter. Hunter is a partner of mine with LaBarba, and the whole idea behind LaBarba. Not the whole idea, but a big portion of it was the fact that we're all in the wine industry. You know, we all like to pair spirits with cigars and wines with cigars. And the red label we blended specifically to go with bourbon. And this one is a wine cigar like I've never tasted before in my life. And you know, I know Robbie didn't get the floral notes, but I think the next one I send, because they're a little bit older now, that he'll get those floral notes, and that went really well with the Treasure Hunter cab that I was drinking, because it was spicy and floral and sweet, and the Treasure Hunter had the same kind of flavors, but it was very interesting to pair them. So,
well, we've got another mod, Catfish, and Catfish definitely gravitates towards the sort of Dominican floral end of the spectrum, so I think that's one of the cigars we'll have to float his way and get his opinion, because he tends to really, really like you know, that subtle, complex floral note, whereas some of the other guys, like Logan, not a huge fan, so we'll get a few guys on that and see if we can get some different opinions and see what kind of flavors we can get picked up from the group.
Yeah, I would love that.
I just switched over the Chianti, and I've made a terrible, terrible mistake. The Chianti, although it's a great wine, I don't think it's a great pairing with the cigar. It's a little too dry. So I'm getting some like really initial burst of fruit and brightness, but then it becomes very, very dry, and I'm finding the short run a little leathery on the finish, so the two together you know, making my mouth pucker. Like, it's really hard to, I would say that the two are not, they're not contrasting, and they're definitely not assisting each other in a complementary way at all.
Well, and again, back to that question, the first question that we answered, that's a perfect example of of what we're talking about is you would never know that unless you did it. So now, from now on, you know, maybe you don't want to pair that type of cigar or that type of tobacco with that type of wine.
And, yeah, I mean, I think, like, we get this question from the audience all the time about, and this is certainly geared towards you as well, is how do you know something is going to pair well together? And, you know, leaning on my cooking background, sometimes you don't. Like, sometimes you just, for me, for cooking, you know, I throw a bunch of stuff together, and I've certainly made some donkey meals that, you know, like, literally I've said, look, honey, I'm throwing this out. I'm going to start fresh because this is terrible. But I think, you know, you can't be afraid to experiment with food or drink because, you know, at least for me, if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you're not getting any growth and you're not discovering anything new, at least for me.
And isn't that the fun part about it? I mean, isn't that why we're doing what we're doing?
I certainly think so, and it's, I mean, certainly in the cigar industry, it's, I have my favorites, and I have my go-tos, and people ask all the time, you know, what's your go-to? But one of the great things, it's an exploration, you know, you're trying out new things, you're, in some cases, you're discovering new flavor combinations that you didn't even think were possible. You know, whiskey is that way for me, and cigars are definitely that way for me. And, I'm definitely a novice when it comes to wine. I like drinking it, but I have a lot to learn. I am not a level 3 sommelier when it comes to wine.
I don't feel like I am either.
Do you ever find... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was
going to say, do you ever find... Because I know I just recently had the experience where I went into a whiskey tasting, and I usually feel pretty comfortable with whiskey tastings. I've been to a lot. And I had my first experience where I went into a whiskey tasting, and I felt like a complete bumbling idiot. Like, the people I was with were sort of, you know, to coin a phrase, grade 12 or university, and I'm sitting there thinking, I'm comfortable, and they're going, wow, these guys really blew me out of the water. What's that like in the wine industry? What's that like with your peers?
It's so funny because I'm not very I'm gonna be 30 in a week, and I've been doing this. I've been in the wine business since I actually took my first. I'm gonna make a little confession. My first wine class I took when I was 20, and I told them I was 21. So,
we'll blank that out later. So the
yeah, don't get knocking. Right. Well, I've done a lot of worse things, but the I went to a wine taste in Cleveland where Bo Barrett was giving a speech, and he owns Chateau Montelena, and he was in that. The movie Bottle Shock was based on Bo Barrett. And he made the award-winning he didn't make the award-winning Chardonnay, but he brought it to France for the Judgment of Paris tasting. And I went to this taste, and it was like all the, I mean, it's Cleveland, so it was certainly not New York City, you know, so the people were still pretty pompous and pretentious in Cleveland, but not near as bad as it would have been in Napa or New York, or especially the super snobs in wine. And I know everyone's going to kill me for saying that, but I had to sit at a table all by myself because I was 20 years old and nobody took me seriously, and everybody was kind of turning their nose up at me. But it turned out to be one of the best experiences of my life, because the only seat open was the seat next to me, actually my whole table. And Bo Barrett sat down next to me, and we started talking. We talked for probably 3 hours. So he ignored all the people that, you know, were kind of like had their noses in the air about everything, and knew a lot more than I did at the time. But it turns out, by having that experience, I learned more in that day of sitting and talking with Bo Barrett than I pretty much had learned ever in wine, you know.
I mean, that's a great experience, and you're right. I think I've certainly felt the same way, where I sat down at a table by myself. I can't say I've ever had a distillery master sit down next to me, which would be I'd probably work to contain myself and not be a fanboy. I'm actually going to be turning 40 next year, and I only really got into heavy spirits a few years ago from a friend of mine, but I've sort of made it my mission per se. To learn as much as I can, and it's interesting to hear stories like that. I think that really helps color the experience when you're tasting or when you're pairing. So, are you switching at this point?
Yeah, I am going to switch, actually. I'm going to, because the cigar is too light for this Dariush. Although I am going to finish that later because it's an awesome cigar. I'm going to smoke a, well, you tell me what you think. So I have a big cab, and I'm thinking Jericho Hill. So I'm thinking, because this wine's pretty spicy, so I'm thinking the sweet from the San Andres, or should I do Casa Fernandez Reserva Corojo?
Wow, you're really putting me on the spot, because I actually enjoy both of those cigars a lot. I'm going to go with the Jericho, because I can't stop talking about that cigar. It really blew me away, both at the IPCPR and afterwards. The nice thing about the Jericho is, you know, he's really done a great job of, because the risk of that San Andreas wrapper is that you can blow away your filler with sweetness. And for me,
it can be bitter and dry. Sorry to interrupt you, but it can be bitter and dry sometimes if you don't have the right tobacco to back it up. So go ahead.
Yeah, so and we'll hopefully it'll color your tasting experience. Is this your first time trying the Jericho Hill or?
No. I had a couple as the show and since the show and.
Okay.
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoy it, and I think and I certainly could be wrong because you know, like I said, I'm a novice when it comes to wine, but I think that Jericho will pair well because it is sweet but not too sweet, and it has this chocolate undertone to it. And a little bit of coffee, and when you're talking about the Cab Sav, I'm thinking, boy, those are two complementary flavor profiles that really could play off of each other nicely in an interesting way. Now, I know before the show I was talking about this Gewürztraminer and how this was a terrible pairing, and curiously enough, it is interesting because the Gewürztraminer is very bright, which is not how I'd normally describe it. But with this cigar, because the cigar is a little on the earthy and leathery side, this Gewürztraminer is actually playing off it very nicely, where it's almost refreshing my palate when I drink it. And I wasn't expecting that at all.
Are you pulling any honey notes out, or are you pulling any sweet notes out of the Gewürztraminer that you weren't before you smoked the cigar? Because I always think that's interesting. Because sometimes I'll taste, because before you were tasting the Gewürztraminer, and you were like, I don't think this is gonna go good. Then you lit the cigar, and I think that sometimes maybe the cigar could pull out some flavors of that Gewürztraminer that wouldn't normally be out of it.
You know, I would say that yes, for sure. I'm getting some chlorophyll and a lot of floral notes that I don't normally. I mean, it's there, but I mean, it's really standing out for me, and it's almost approaching the level of a honeyed mead, which is really curious because I would never. Compared to Gewürztraminer in my mind with the mead at all.
Yeah, I mean, for me, sometimes Gewürztraminers are either really cloyingly sweet or really refreshingly dry, and depending on what I'm smoking in between, will pull up those flavors a little bit. So I think you picked a great cigar to pair with that wine because, like you said, you're getting a lot of earth notes, you're getting a lot of leather notes, where that wine doesn't have any of those components. It does have like the fruit notes and the like the sweeter notes and maybe a little bit of honey notes that kind of pull the whole package together.
So I'm going to swing back to an audience question here because we're getting some really interesting questions. We have a question from Isaac. Isaac comments has some really good questions from each show. And really, he's got a bunch of questions, but I'll start off with the big one, which is, what do you look like? What is a person? What is one looking for in a wine? When you're shopping for a wine, you know, what is it you should be looking for? And it seems like a big question to me.
For me, you know, I when I'm at work, I drink for my customers, so I'm drinking for, you know, I think that this person will like this wine or that person will like that wine. But when I'm shopping for myself, what I'm usually looking at is the pairing. You know, what are we going to eat that night? You know, what am I doing that evening? So if I'm sitting on the porch smoking medium-bodied cigars, I'm going to pull Pinot Noir is my favorite wine. But Pinot Noir for me is I don't have to sit and really think about it. So if I'm at a party and I want to drink Pinot Noir, if I'm at a party, I'm going to want to drink Pinot Noir because it's a very social wine. It's good. It doesn't have a lot of alcohol in it. It's a red wine, so you get those red flavor notes, strawberry, or maybe a rosé on a hot day. it's very situational for me, and it's very, I guess, dependent on what's going on later that night. So if I'm gonna cook a steak with my dad, I mean, you better believe we're getting Napa Valley Cabernets. You know, we're smoking Maduros. You know, and that's my Sunday with my dad. But if I'm eating, you know, with my girlfriend, I'm eating fish, and we're doing something light, or, you know, how girls are, salads or whatever, then I'm gonna drink, I'm gonna drink like a Gewürztraminer or a dry Riesling. I like all wines, just like I like all cigars, and I don't ever prejudice one or the other, but I always look at the situation that I'm gonna be in later that evening.
Would you say that you ever sort of gravitate to, from a pairing perspective, do you tend to gravitate one way or the other? Like when you pick up a wine, do you find yourself more often than not saying, I'm picking this up because this is going to go really well with the steak, or do you just pick up the wine because, you know, like what is driving that specifically for you when you're out shopping? If you ever have to shop for wine, do you even have to shop for wine?
Yeah, because my girlfriend lives in Jacksonville, so it's actually I have to fly down there to see her, so it's actually a fun experience for me to be a customer. You know, usually I'll just, you know, whatever I tasted that week, I'll take home and drink with my dad when we're up here. You know, pick up a bottle at the shop, but down there they have different wines and they have different distributors, so it's fun for me to go down there and go to, when I go to Miami to see Robbie, you know, I can go to wine stores and pick out stuff that's not available up here, stuff that I've never had. And it's a whole new experience for me being a customer, because I can go, when I go in to talk to the other sommeliers, or when I'm at dinner down there and I talk to the sommeliers, I'm totally at their behest, where I worked in restaurants and I was a wine rep for a while as well, and I was in control of what everybody else was drinking. But now I'm on that other side, and it's super fun. And sometimes for me the food goes around the wine, and sometimes the wine goes around the food, and sometimes the cigar goes around the wine, and sometimes the wine goes around the cigar. There's no you know, formula for me personally. I don't know how you are with it, but you know, it just happens.
So I mean, Isaac's got a really good second question, which hopefully I can phrase politically correct and doesn't get anybody into trouble. But really, I think what he's asking is there some sort of general consensus in terms of what, you know, what you immediately know, and I'm assuming this is going to be a region, what you immediately can recognize as this is going to be good, versus say, you know, a boxed wine from your BevMo or supermarket that maybe isn't on the fine end of the spectrum.
Yeah, regionally specific wines are, you know, especially for me personally, I like Bordeaux and I like Burgundies, and I like Pinot Noir from Oregon. I like Red Zinfandel from Southern California. I like Syrah from Southern California, and I like Cabernet blends from Washington. And if I see those, you know, ACs or AVAs, you know, regardless of what country, or in regards to what country you're looking at, I'll pick up a bottle and I'll try it. And when I first met my girlfriend, you know, she fell in love with me, and I fell in love with her. It was a love at first sight thing, and it was about wine, and it was about me describing those regions and why they're so important, and why each one of those has different characteristics. And I might be getting off topic with the question, but you know, I pick up everything, and I told her, you could pick up a $10 Bordeaux and not like it, and still drink it, but once you have that experience, then you go from there, and it's very palate specific, it's very person specific, just like cigars are. So if you pick up a $10 Bordeaux or a $15 Bordeaux, it could blow your mind. And you could pick up a $10, $15 Bordeaux, and it will be the worst thing you've ever tasted in your life. But now you know, like, this area, like, specifically, like, Vindipede Dock is not my area. I don't like that wine. So just stay away from it. And it's very trial and error oriented, where, you know, I haven't known you that long, and I don't know your palate, so you may not think that something that I love is any good at all. Same with cigars. So my goal is to talk to you about it and figure out, you know, this is your A, B, C, D, E, F, and G of things that you like. Where can we go from there? You know, say you like Cabernet, you said earlier. So where can we go from there to expand you in Cabernet? We can go to Bordeaux. We can go to California, Northern, Southern. We can go to Washington. We can go to all these different places and taste these different things. And then we start focusing on winemakers and why winemakers specifically have those different little nuances that you might appreciate.
Well, I asked you a huge question, and that actually took us right to the end of our regular segment here. So thanks very much for all AFRN listeners for tuning in.
Thank you.
Tune in on the 28th, which is week Thursday for Villager Cigars, and we'll switch over to our After Dark segment. And as Logan likes to say, we're fucking back. So it's interesting for me because I was in California not too long ago, and it was actually my first experience getting to tour the vineyards there and the wineries there. And I'll tell you, I mean, I was absolutely blown away by some of the smaller vineyards there, some of the smaller wineries there. Do you have? How many wineries are in the Napa Valley?
Oh, I mean, in Napa County alone, there's thousands, man. I mean, the last time I was there, you know, you could go. It's funny though. The thing that's funny about Napa is you're going up. I can't remember the name of the road. Jeremy could probably tell me, but there's a road that goes right through the middle of Napa, and on the right is Opus One. On the left is Silver Oak, you know, and then there's like Franzia or whatever, like right next to Opus One, and you're like, your mind explodes. Like, how could they make wine this good right here, and then wine like this right here? And that's a winemaker thing. I don't know.
I've been learning about the tobacco industry in terms of the growing aspect, and you know, a lot of people ask questions about growing regions, and I mean, I know from my family being from the farming industry. You know, you can go 2 miles down the road and get a completely different soil composition. I mean, I can't even, in my mind, I can't even fathom how you would begin to understand without just trial and error what you're going to get out of the soil with what you're planting.
I think it's the only way to do it. I mean, you have to, you know, when I was talking about Barrett, that story I was telling you earlier, he was ripping up all of his, like, award-winning Cabernet and Chardonnay, and I was like, why are you doing that? And he's like, you know, the climate shifted over here and we just can't, it's not the right place for Cab anymore. It's more of a Zinfandel kind of place. And we started tasting some Zinfandel and it was lights out. And he's like, I'm replanting all those award-winning Cab things with Zinfandel just because, you know, we're not happy with it. And it's a big risk to take. And it's going to take him, like we were talking about earlier, it's going to take him 7 years. Well, this was, you know, a while ago, 10 years ago, but I was going to take him 7 years to transition that out. So he would plant, you know, keep growing the Cab here and plant the Zinfandel over here, then rip up this Cab and plant Zinfandel here, and then over here, you know, plant or keep growing the Cab. And then, you know, he moved block by block and lot by lot. But that's a major transition when you're talking about a property that's worth a couple hundred million dollars, you know.
And before this segment, you were telling me that you said from an initial, like if you start out as a vineyard, you don't actually get production for 7 years.
Right, 7 years.
And I mean, how much are they investing in a vineyard that you have to sit on that for? Like, what are we talking for? I mean, roughly for a startup of a vineyard.
When I was in Napa, I was at the Rutherford Grill. No, yeah, I think it was the Rutherford Grill. I can't remember the name of the restaurant exactly, but it sits right next to, ironically enough, Darius, which I'm drinking their Caravan now. It sits next to their Malbec vineyard in Napa. And there is a for sale sign in the vineyard, so I, just being me, was asking the waiter, I'm like, how much are they asking for that property? And he's like, $4 million an acre.
An acre?
For Malbec in
wow.
Napa. Imagine what Cabernet is going for. You know?
Wow. Okay. I mean, that's crazy money to me. I don't know how any. I mean, you'd have to have a huge amount of capital to even think about getting into the wine industry.
Yeah. The barrier to entry. I mean, if you can get in the wine industry, I mean, you could contract. You know, you could work with a wine grower. And in Burgundy, for example, you know, the winemakers don't own the vineyards, but in California, it's very Chateau specific, and in Bordeaux it's very Chateau specific. So the winemaking facility and the house sits on the property where they get their grapes. But in Burgundy, that's not the case. And in Burgundy, you have winemakers and you have wine growers, and they have these contracts for certain plots of land with the landowners to buy. I want to buy lot 23 of your Pinot Noir from the, you know, Romani Conti vineyard or the Chazu vineyard. And they have all these contracts, so the grapes then come to them, then they make the wine, and then the wine goes to what's called a négociant, or a guy that can bring the wine to the States. And all those steps of the process are very important, because the land out there in Burgundy, you know, you can't go there now as in 2014 and say, I want to buy Pinot Noir property, because they'll laugh at you, because it's the land is priceless at this point.
So I mean, what you're talking about really sounds to me like huge parallels between the wine industry and the tobacco industry, because we talk all the time with the tobacco guys, you being one of them, where you've got guys who are buying tobacco from other plantations, and you've got guys who are vertically integrated who have gone to that point where they're actually buying out entire fields. So, right. I mean, are with the wine industry, do they have any appetite for that? Do they want to buy up these, or are they happy with the business contracts that they have?
I mean, most of the esteemed, you know, the esteemed winemakers that have the contracts in Burgundy are very happy, because they've had, you know, even that barrier to entry is tough, because you can't get those certain plots of land that make the great Pinot Noir, because, you know, guys like Albert Bigeau, or, you know, I can't even think of anything right now, my brain's too fried, but, you know, there's a lot of guys over there that have these contracts, but they've been buying wine from Romani Conti for 200 years. I mean, and now you go there and you're like, I want to buy some grapes, and they're like, yeah, good luck, man. You get the vines by the trash can, you know?
So, I mean, that's exactly like the tobacco industry, where you have to have that clout in order to get that sort of premier tobacco, that particular tobacco you're after, and then, of course, that's just all you're doing is raising the price of that that particular leaf.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how long has California been around in the winemaking business?
Legitimately since before Prohibition, but on the map, 1975,
I mean, when you're talking $4 million an acre, there has to be an appetite for some of these growers to want to move the industry to some other place where it's not $4 million an acre. Is it feasible to move to somewhere else in the States, or do you have to start looking at another country?
Washington and Oregon, they're making some awesome wines, and the land's not that expensive right now, and not only that, is it's like the Wild West up there. It's like how Napa used to be, and that's why I love it. You know, you got guys that are doing crazy stuff. Like, I know we're talking about wine, so it can't be that crazy, but I mean, they're doing crazy stuff, like stuff that no one's ever heard of in the wine industry, and they're getting away with it because the land is inexpensive and you can grow strange grapes and not be too indebted. Like, back in the day in Napa, you could grow Sangiovese, or you could grow Dolcetto, or you could grow Italian grape varietals, and you could experiment. But now, you're trying to get all your money back out of your land, so what are you going to grow? You're going to grow Cabernet, you're going to grow Merlot, you're going to grow, you know, unfortunately, you're going to grow Zinfandel, and you're going to make white Zinfandel out of it. I mean, that's where the market is. I mean, you know, you're going to try to get your money back out of it. But a lot of the guys in Napa are buying secondary properties up north and even into Vancouver and those areas. They're buying properties up north and making secondary projects like they're where they can do pilot batches or experimental things.
So, and this is really a question just for me because, you know, most of my experience is in the whiskey, scotch side of things. Right now in the whiskey industry, there's this real push because the demand is grossly outstripping their production. And you see them, not all of them certainly, but some of the larger companies are making decisions that are based on economics, which, hey, you know, at the end of the day, you got to pay the bills. And so they're moving away from age statement and moving towards something that's really just generating money. So is there an appetite or is there a tendency in the wine industry where companies are going away from vineyards or wineries are going away from maybe a premier product and going towards something that, you know, quote unquote box wine that they know is going to sell a million gallons that week? Or how does that play out in the wine industry?
Exactly the same as it does in the cigar industry. You have your guys that are will never do anything but what they love and what they're passionate about, and you have guys that, you know, will, you know, and you have the it's the same exact thing. You know, I'm not going to obviously call anybody specific out, but it's the same concept basically. So, you know, you have winemakers that were some of the most premier winemakers in the world at one point, and now they're getting older and they're like, we just want to make money, so we're just going to sell what sells. The beer industry is the same way. And like you said, in the spirits industry, all the luxury good market, it's such a niche market that you have to kind of, you know, sell out, I guess, you know, if you're trying to make a living out of it. Or you can stay where you're at and, I guess, not make a living out of it, I guess, if you're trying to get rich. So there's people that are trying to get rich, and there's people that are trying to do what they love. And I think that people like us that want to do what we love are gonna continue to make good product and have fun doing it. And that's what life's about to me.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I say that now, you know, maybe my opinion would change if I'm getting $1 million a week from production sales. I mean, maybe my attitude would change, but I like to think that if I was a winemaker or a distiller, that I'm in it for the love of it, and I'm in it to make a product that I know people are going to love and be passionate about. And I think, you know, we really haven't talked about La Barba, but watching the Cigar Chat on Monday, and if for those out there who haven't watched it, please catch it on YouTube. You know, I certainly got the impression from you that you are absolutely in it for the passion of the cigar.
Absolutely, man. That's the only reason why I wanted to get into the business. You know, I saw my dad, you know, for my entire life and how much he loved it and how hard it was for us to make it happen. You know, he could have been actually legitimately a professional golfer. He's a scratch golfer. He could have gone pro. But he loves the cigar industry and the wine industry so much that he stuck with it. And it was watching him struggle, but watching that struggle versus the reward at the end of the day when, you know, I would smell that 858 when he would get home at night. And he would go out and sit by the bonfire with his buddies and smoke and drink and have a great time. I finally got why I shouldn't be a lawyer or I shouldn't be an accountant, you know, personally. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with any of those professions, but for me, that's where that came from, and that's where that passion lies, is in that experience I had with my dad.
Well, you know, and I think I definitely feel where you're coming from, because I like to think, for everybody, you want to do what you love, and hopefully the goal for everybody is eventually you can actually make some money at it. But, you know, we only got one shot at it, so you kind of got to enjoy the ride while you're at it, and there's no sense going through life miserable, at least for me.
Absolutely.
I don't think that'd be the one.
Absolutely, man.
But we're up against the clock, and, you know, we've taken an hour of your time. And, Tony, I want to say again, thanks very much for short notice. For those who aren't aware, Tony was on our Monday show. Please check it out, YouTube. Where can they follow you on it? I know you're huge into the in the social media, so where can people follow you?
Yeah, Instagram is at Bellatto, B-E-L-L-A-T-T-O. Twitter is Tony Bellatto or La Barba Cigars. Craig runs the La Barba Cigars Instagram. Facebook's just Tony Bellatto or La Barba Cigars, either one. So I'm out there.
And everyone, check out. We're gonna have some La Barba reviews coming up. Some group reviews as soon as we get them out to our mods here. Appreciate everyone checking in. Please tune in next Wednesday. It'll be my last show before I go to Vegas, and hopefully don't get too crazy in Vegas. And we're gonna do something a little different next week. We're gonna move away from spirits, and we're doing the Sody Pop. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, it's, you know, I want to kind of do something a little crazy, and a lot of people do Dr. Pepper, root beer, Coke, whatever. So we're going to kind of shake things up, and maybe get some of those non-drinking mods on here to talk about Soda Pop. But thanks again, Tony, for coming in and co-hosted tonight, really. So,
well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And we'll have you on the show again. I'm sure we're going to want you on Cigar Chat again pretty soon, so Logan and Bob will be reaching out to you.
Yeah, whatever, man. I'm down for whatever. You guys are great. So I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.